Why does live theater matter? We answer that question and more this week on Only Stupid Answers. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Only Stupid Answers. This is the show where we answer your questions about movies, TV shows, comic books, and this week, live theater. I'm your host, DJ Wooldridge. With me, as always, is Roxy Stryer. Hi, Roxy.
Hi, DJ. You want to know the realization I'm having live on air right now?
Yes, please share.
There's a girl staying with me this week, and she definitely left the coffee pot and the Keurig, and now my tea tastes like coffee, DJ.
Oh, no.
Tea I already spilled this morning, and not in the fun kind of tea spilling way. It's been a morning.
It's been a morning, and you just have to spill the rest of it and make some new tea.
On my laptop this time. I'm going to spill the tea.
Unless,
hopefully it's in the drain.
Unless you want to. Unless you maybe you spill more and you just got to go through the other side.
Yes.
Roxy really doesn't understand how to spill the tea. She's really confused about
I heard about it once, so I tried it.
I tried.
I don't understand. Who's that other voice? Wait. It's our very special guest.
Why do the kids love doing this? Why do they?
They love spilling the tea. I just kept hearing about spilling the tea. I think it's kind of overrated.
Yeah. Seems like it might have ruined my laptop. Malcolm, the kids at home can hear your voice. For those that aren't familiar, who are you?
Well, let me tell you something. If you aren't familiar with me, I don't know why you're watching this episode of Only Stupid Answers. But my name is Malcolm Barrett. I'm most known for acting for the last 20 years. I can name shows if they're, you know what? SAG's not watching this.
I can confirm they are not.
Some off the air shows that I'm on.
Yes.
Where's Preacher and Timeless and Better Off Ted and stuff like that. And then there's shows I'm on now. I guess I'm not supposed to talk about them, but I can if it's a strike, I think. So for the sake of the strike, I'm on Average Joe and Changeling. Because that's what I'm talking about today is the strike.
But
I don't know. I also rap and do a lot of stand-up comedy. I'm going to be, by the time you guys see this, I'll probably be doing a fucking stand-up somewhere.
Yeah. You're doing a show tonight with friend of the show, Jay Washington.
Yes, with Jay Washington. I'm doing a show at the Improv, and then I think on the 6th, I'm doing a show at Flappers and other shows that come up, I'm sure. Yeah.
There's other people on that show, too, but they haven't been on our show, so I don't care about them.
It's only him and Jay. That's all that we care about.
That's all we care about. So, little business up top. As always, if you'd like to watch the show without ads, if you'd like to see it live, if you'd like to check out Patreon-exclusive shows like Spider-Versity or our Q&A, you can do that over at patreon.com/onlystupidanswers. If you give us a 5-star review on iTunes, that's the one. We really appreciate it. On Spotify, every week we ask you all a question. Last week's question was a poll. Would you ever give stand-up comedy a try? The options were, I have... I haven't, but I would. I would never. So before Roxy can cheat, she can look at the doc. Don't look at the doc, Roxy.
Okay, I haven't.
How do we think this...
I haven't, but I would.
But you would. How do we think this shook out with our audience? The three options against were I have, I haven't, but I would. I would never.
I'm not trying to throw shade at half of our audience, but the I haven't, but I would people are a little full of crap, right? Like, you can't just say, like, I haven't gone... on a rocket ship, but I would. Like,
if the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah, it just doesn't count for anything. So I don't know that I trust any of those people.
Yeah.
So I feel like that probably won because nobody can be trusted these days.
Malcolm, how do you think this poll shook out? If you had to guess. And you do because I asked you to.
I think it's 33% for everything. It's going to be... I think a lot of people are going to be like, I'm definitely a stand-up, even though I've done zero.
Yes.
And then someone's going to be like, oh, yeah, I would definitely do that probably.
Yeah.
If I thought about it.
Listen, I have a set in my head. It'll be perfect. I know it. Yeah. I would if open mic just presented itself in front of me, I'd be good to go.
No way I didn't kill.
Yeah.
And then there's some weird 33% of people who don't want attention. So I think that'll.
Do they exist anymore? Who doesn't want attention? What?
I don't know.
It's an attention economy. What are we doing? Okay, so here's how broke down: 43% for I have, 14% for I haven't, but I would, and 43% for I would never.
So okay. I was super wrong.
Yes.
43% of our audience has tried stand up.
So they claim.
Liars.
Cannot confirm, but that is what they claim. Wow. So
that's your crowd, that's your audience, that's your demographic.
Yes, yeah.
Well, okay. In all fairness, it does make sense on the episode that we had stand up Mark Ellis come on to talk about stand up. That a lot of people listening to that episode, in fact, have tried stand up and were interested in listening to the episode because they are stand up. So I should have outsmarted the system on that one.
So. Malcolm, I think you've been doing stand-up for as long as I've known you. How long have you been doing, for all the stuff you do, where does stand-up fall? When did you start doing that?
It's a weird number. Me and stand-up been off and on dating. I probably started doing stand-up 20 years ago in New York.
Okay.
Handful of times. I couldn't even say. I did sketch comedy a ton and just different types of things, but I probably only did stand-up maybe 10 times. Okay. And then about 2-3 years ago, you know, I got a friend group with a couple stand-ups, little chat group. I'm like the only non-stand-up in it. And at some point they were like, hey, you should do it. You know, one of them had a show. They were like, you should come on it, blah, blah, blah. And then I did it and I got addicted again. I was like, well, this is great. You know, and it's a great outlet, particularly, you know, when you get frustrated in the acting world, to be able to have a voice and go, here's what I have to say, and also build a name for yourself. So I've probably been doing it hardcore for the last 3 years, and still not nearly as much as my friends, my buddies who really do this. Yeah. And you know, I'm never going to catch up to them because they've been doing it as their primary job for, you know, 10, 15 some odd years. But probably the last 3 years, I've really been going hard, particularly because they're like, hey, you're not. I remember I got an email from, I went to like my agents and, you know, they're not great at representing me for anything that isn't just acting. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you know, I'm doing stand up and they were like, you're not ready. And I was like, fuck them, man. You know, and I went to my friends. I was like, they said, I'm not ready. And they were like, well, how often are you doing stand up? I was like, once a month or every 2 months or 3 months or 4 months. And they all were like, you're not ready.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. So I've been spite performing. I've been performing with spite
for the last
couple of months, just going intense, just to prove something to everyone else, really.
I respect that because I feel like I have a similar instinct when somebody's like, well, you can't do it. I'm like, fuck you. Fuck you, I can't do it.
Why would you say I have any limitations whatsoever? Yeah. That's crazy.
It is super challenging, though, when you decide you want to be a multi-hyphenate to figure out like how much of the other thing that is paying you significantly less than the thing that you're good at and more established in that you could actually be spending your time in. It's like a very tricky balance. And it's also challenging to find representation and a support system that allows you to not just be one thing. What's the plan of attack here for you? Are you going to just say the big F you and keep going down the stand-up path while also acting and rapping?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, it's really it. I mean, the same thing happened for writing. Like, and honestly, it's one of those things that I probably pick up more when there are lulls. Mm-hmm. Like when the pandemic happened is when I started writing more, you know, and Black Lives Matter was at its height. And so it was really intense and focused on really trying to pitch a bunch of shows and writing a bunch of shows. And it took a little bit for my team to get on board, but eventually they did. And that's just kind of how it is, you know what I mean? You kind of always have to prove yourself in some other arena. And to an extent, it makes sense. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, you know, when I got started as getting repped by these folks as an actor, I had some acting behind me. You know what I mean? I had some proven paychecks behind me. And so, you know, I think that's always sort of the thing for everyone in this industry is like, I have no faith in you until you show me you can completely do this and overcome in every single way. Then I'll definitely back you, mm-hmm. you know? Yep. And so it's that sort of thing. So I just...
And then they'll say, I believed in you from the start.
Yes.
Yeah, I was always there.
Yeah. Today is the day I'll start believing in you from the beginning.
Yep. Right.
So I just kind of do it, man. I'm, you know, stand up, writing, rapping, whatever it is. I just kind of do it. You know, it's, I think it's going to be hard for me. I always appreciate seeing the folks who are able to do all these things at that level. Yeah. And so, you know, for me, it always takes a distraction or something not happening. Like now we're in a strike, you know? So I'm like, time to do stand up every day of my life, yeah. You know? Which I guess kind of proves one, you know, my success is at acting, but two, probably that's where my passion is. You know, my yeah. passion is at the acting, and it's always going to be what I do.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do got to say, because obviously the last few years have been tumultuous, let's say. And I have a lot of respect for the way that you've been able to pivot into other things when COVID lockdowns are happening. So you're not on set. So you started doing your show on Instagram and stuff like that. And now, you know, the strike's going on. So you're doing stand up. I've always thought that, I've always respected that about you, your ability to pivot.
Yes.
Yeah.
I gotta pivot. I mean, when a pandemic happened, I think that's when I started going into voiceover, or trying to do voiceover, or finding reps for voiceover and all that. Cause I didn't know if acting was going to keep going or how long, you know. It was a really indefinite period for us as performers, you know, and folks weren't even doing stand-up when we were at the height of the pandemic, because it was just like, you know, we're not sure we're allowed and to be around each other. So I was like, voiceover, it's me in a booth. You know, so it's, I always feel like that that scene in the Biggie movie with Puffy, where just like, you put me out in the jungle and I'll make a fur coat out of lion. You know what I mean? Like, that was more Tracy Moore than Puffy. But
there was a little Tracy in there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Picasso, you take my paints and I'll paint with my finger in water or whatever it is. What?
That's me talking to my friend who's been doing acting class.
Yeah. Oh, have her tell us what you learned in it. Let's get her on. Let's do it. I also appreciate the fact that you're like, you have friends that do stand up and you're like, oh man, I could do this. Cause I'm the revert. Like I'll see Mike do stand up. It's like, well, I'm never going to be as good as this. So I'm just not going to try. I'm just not going to even bother trying.
There's definitely some days it feels like that. There's definitely some days, like I started following more comics on Instagram and every once in a while I'll see something. I'm like, that's pretty funny. What am I doing? Like, what am I adding to the freaking populace?
Yeah.
Telling jokes. Like who needs that?
Well, you did say earlier, you said something interesting, like the friends who had been doing it for so long, you'll never catch up. I didn't know that. Do you feel like there's a direct correlation between how long you've been doing it and how good you are?
100%. Yes. Yeah. I think, I mean, they have tons of experience. I mean, and also the friends I'm talking about, like, it's like you can watch Def Comedy Jam and see their old performances. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the span of what they're doing and the experience that they have is so great. And I learned that even coming back, because, you know, I was cocky when I first started doing stand-up, and I was cocky when I came back doing stand-up. Like, I was like, I did it. I was like, it's my time again, you know? And then I think the second time I performed after that was like the driest crowd I had ever. It's like a crowd of 15. And I was like, what? Oh my God. And I think I stopped maybe just short. I didn't take as many pauses. It was my friend Eric's, the second time he had me do a show. And I just didn't take as many pauses because the crowd wasn't, you know, going crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm like, great. And there's my final joke. And I'm like, all right, I'm getting out of here. Mm-hmm. And then Eric comes out. He's like, did you see the red light? I'm like, no. He's like, and he comes out in front of the audience. He's like, hey, so you guys, Malcolm doesn't know anything about stand-up. He's supposed to wait for the red light to go off. So I'm sorry. He's new to all of this. Okay, he's from theater. So go ahead and do more stuff. And at the time, I literally only had 10 minutes. I literally had 10 minutes of material that I marked out. It was great. And so now I'm fighting, trying to find, I'm looking through notes and trying to put these half written jokes I had in the back of my head together and go. And then I finish, I do what I think is probably about 5-6 more minutes. Cause he's like, you only went 5 minutes. I was like, oh my God. Okay. I go 5-6 more minutes. I go back in the dressing room and I'm like, you know, I felt like I did 10 minutes. He was like, nah, man, you only did like 5 or 6. I was like, okay, I recorded it. I guess I'll check at home. And one of the other stand-ups is like, or you could check now. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And I check and I'm like, I look at the time and I'm like, Eric. He's like, what? I was like, man, I did 9 minutes and 50 seconds.
Yeah.
And I was like, you made me do 5 more minutes. I was like, I did a 15-minute set. Yeah. He's like, oh, all right. And he just moved on. And, you know, I think the idea was to teach me that it's never, that you're going to have times like this. You're not necessarily going to be able to do your, you know, your prepared set in every environment. Like your time is going to change. The people are going to change. The responses are going to be different. And that's something you can only learn by experience. You can only learn how you personally adapt in the moment by experience. You know what I mean? That's not something anybody can teach you. And so that's, you know, I'm even a much different stand-up than I was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And that now I don't need to prepare a set. Like my first set, it took me 2 months because I was like, each of these jokes is going to be perfect and I've got it and blah, 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 and this and that. And now, like, I got a set tonight and I haven't practiced it at all. I will at some point, but like, I don't think about it as strongly because now I know how to press and play and plug and play jokes in my head. And I have more than one set. And so if I wanted to go and talk about alcoholism for a little bit, I can do that. If I want to talk about, you know, love life for a little bit, I can do it a little more organically than I would have been able to 2 years ago.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I feel like in there was a perfect transition to our main topic. However, not having learned the lesson that you just relayed to me about adapting, I'm going to go into news instead. So we've got some big news this week. Obviously, we've been talking about the strike a lot on this show, but the dual strikes. The WGA has reached a deal with the AMPTTP, and it is official, right? It's over. As of 12:01 a.m. PST, September 27th, after 148 days, the writers' portion of the strike has ended.
To an extent, because they still have to ratify the contract.
Well, and I was kind of wondering, that was my understanding as well, and depending on who I was reading, it felt like that was kind of like just a ceremonial, and I was like, I don't know, sounds like it's kind of a big deal. Sounds like it's kind of important to have happen.
I don't see the writers not approving this deal. They obviously, the people in charge for the captains and the people who are negotiating with your favorite word, DJ, the AMPTP.
Yeah. Hey, listen, even they didn't get it right in their memo, all right? So I'm allowed to not be able to keep track of it.
I know. They were clearly speaking on behalf of the writers, though. So the vote, I do kind of feel like it's already signed, sealed, delivered. But you are right that it is not technically yet.
Yeah, they still have to vote on it. I think the it's mostly, folks have been mostly positive about it. I think folks are more positive about this than a DGA deal, and a DGA deal went through.
Yeah.
Those mother efforts didn't have to go on strike.
Yeah. So I think this one will more than likely get passed. There's folks that had questions about the minimums and things like that, and usually it's the screenwriters who have some amount of issues because they feel like they get left back in all of the issues that have to deal with the rooms and things like that. I think they got more in terms of, you know, responding to things like residuals and things like that and credits and AI protections. I think there are more things where they're not left behind. Same for variety writers.
Yeah.
Were you guys able to look at all the deal points? Were you guys able to look to check out the deal points? Because the AI one that you just mentioned had me super worried still. And I'm kind of curious what the general consensus has been on it, because one of the concessions that they had to make in negotiations, this does happen, but that you are still able to use work to train the AI, and which to me just sounds like effing theft.
You're still able to use what?
Work, people's work to train the AI. So the AI is still using people.
Yeah, but that's not our contract, like whether you can use AI to training people's work to use AI. Our contract one, or, and I'm saying our contract, but it's really WGA, but not having it directly in front of me, but the biggest things it got were you can't use AI to write scripts. You can't use AI. If you have used AI, you can't use it to undermine credit. You can't use it to rewrite people's work, things like that. So the training of AI is going to be specific to if you run ChatGPT, mm-hmm. right? That's not going to be to the WGA. And they also sent out, I think they sent out, but I only know because I'm friends with writers. So I went to a website that had all of the things
yeah.
out there.
Yeah.
So I think it's available and open out. But yeah, the AI protections, there's about at least 6 or 7 rules that come off the top of my head that were directly protecting the writers from the use of AI and having a credit.
Yeah, I looked at all of that, and some of them are really great, but obviously looking forward to future contract negotiations when AI has been fully trained based off of all of their work. It just seems
yeah.
like we're entering into foreign territory right now, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, 100%.
That they figured out, even like the 6-person minimum rooms that they wanted across the board, but they're only taking place on certain rooms. All of those concessions make sense. The only one that I was like, oh my gosh, what is the future actually going to look like here, is in regards to the AI, because it's still existent in this sphere and there was yeah. going to be no way to completely shut that down. It's just a scary premise. And I'm curious how that ends up coming over to when in a couple of days SAG sits down at the table, whether or not that it's going to be translated there as well, where they're able to use AI to train or actual work to train AI, because then in a few years when people are renegotiating, this AI is going to be a behemoth. It's going to do all the things.
Yeah. But again, the actual AI of training the AI is not a thing that's like, because that's going to be, that's a separate thing, but also it's why you're seeing all these lawsuits popping off right yeah. now.
I know.
Like there's a bunch of writers, either they be WGA or there's a couple novelists. You know, I got a friend Cecil who's a comic book person. I feel like BJ may know her.
Yeah.
So I think there are lawsuits that are popping up directly relating to AI, and all of the ones in a WGA are directly related to how AMTP can use AI for the scripts. Like ours is AI can't write or rewrite literary material. They will not be considered source material, so they can't be used to undermine a writer's credit. Writer can choose to use AI when performing writer's services if the company consents and provided the writers have the applicable policies. Company must disclose to the writer if materials given to the writer have been generated by AI. The WGA reserves the right to assert the exploitation of writers' materials to train AI. So that's, I think that one addresses what you're talking about.
Well, that is exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the WGA reserves the right to assert that exploitation of writers' material to train AI is prohibited by the contract.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting too, because I've seen a few headlines that are like, here's the one thing that is wrong with the WGA, da, 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 and always different things. Each headline is, this is the one thing. And I've seen some people online point out, I think correctly, that like, listen, man, corporations are going to corporate and they're going to try and do every, in the next 3 years, they're going to try and find every little loophole and wiggle room yeah. that they can, you know, that you're totally. As great as this deal is, you're going to have to babysit them and make sure they're not screwing people yeah. over. And that's just the reality. That's just the reality yeah. of existing in America in 2023.
Yeah. And honestly, like, look, these concerns that Roxy are talking about, and there's other concerns about the room minimums that she's talking yeah. about. These are all of the things that I think when you talk about, is the contract 100% ready? Like it's definitely going. I think these are the concerns where it's like, well, this may not be 100%, or these are the concerns that people are having that may not have it officially just go straight through, right? And that happens in negotiations, as you said, all the time. Like it's a big deal, because I think we got 3 times the amount that they initially said they were going to give us in terms yeah. of the dollar amount of the package. I think we got $233 million, and it was supposed to be $83 million. That was the most that they said. And, you know, a lot of the things that they said they wouldn't move on, they moved on. And these were things they said they wouldn't move on during the director's negotiation. Mm-hmm. So it's very positive, I think, overall. I think, you know, like you said, I think there's always deterrence. Like, it's always, you know, you're always kind of dealing with, you know, if you ever deal with a basic contract with any TV show, you go in there like, I would like this amount of money. And then they go, we would like to spit in your face. Mm-hmm. And then you go, can you spit a little less in my face and give me $5 more?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how these things go. So you're 100% right in that. There's always going to be things where you're like, unless they give us everything that we ask for each time, there's 100% always going to be things that don't work and we're sore about losing. And, you know, that's kind of how these companies work. Even when they give you a thing, they're trying to create a loophole.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? Even if they go, you know, if you go, we don't want robots, they go, okay, well, we're not going to tell you what robots are. What if we use humanoids?
Mm-hmm.
And then also, we want to take away your money.
Yeah.
Like, they're gonna find some loophole wherever they can, and that's kind of the tricky thing. And it's also kind of why it's disingenuous when they say that they're negotiating in good faith.
Yeah.
Because they're not. They're trying to give the least amount of thing possible.
Yeah.
And then the hope is that with SAG, that the gains that the WGA were able to make, we now can use as a prototype for our contract.
Well, so I was going to ask you about that, is because obviously the SAG's needs aren't the same as WGA's needs. How much of this do you think transfers over into when currently SAG is scheduled to meet with them on Monday? How much of that do you think transfers over and benefits them?
Okay, so it's a couple things, right? I think the hot ticket items will cross over. Like what people don't realize, and I only really fully understood a little bit more this year because I got to sit into the NEGCOM meeting for one day, is that there's a billion things that we propose, and I'm exaggerating, but there's so many things that we propose, from protections for children.
12 pages of things.
Exactly. Yeah. Like from protections to children, to diversity in hair and makeup, to protections about where we shoot, so that, you know, if a woman has a miscarriage or has to have an abortion, that if somebody helps her out, they're not, you know, under penalty of law or threat of penalty of law. So there's a million items that do not make the headlines.
Yeah.
Right. So those items are going to be their own items. Right. But then the items that do cross over are things like protections against AI, success-based royalties, transparency in streaming numbers, things of that nature, things related to how much goes into health and care, pension. I think they asked for a 5% raise that went to 4% the next year, 3%. I think we're aiming for 11%. Mm-hmm. So really those top three items are going to be the things that cross over. And then the value of the package, the idea that we, you know, they have the capacity to spend upwards of $200 million on a total package.
Yeah.
Right. Because all of these measures, these proposals all cost money to an effect.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what is the dollar value of all of that? No. So I think the dollar value of the package, the protections like AI residuals, success-based residuals, I think those are the sort of crossover items that are also the big ticket highlighted newsworthy items. I think those things will cross over, and it just doesn't make sense for them not to.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that I agree with everything you're saying, but there's a lot of things that I think will cross over as well. You know, the transparency on numbers is a huge thing with streamers that already the WGA has paved the way for, that these streaming services are going to have to be more transparent with how many watch time hours there have been, which is of course going to benefit SAG in negotiations, because that's already done. And that's something that SAG cared about as well. But then, like Malcolm mentioned, there's of course things that are not making the headlines that are important to actors that are not something that the WGA had to touch, like how many sides, how many pages you have to learn of a script, and when you have to get auditions in by, what the turnaround time needs to be. You know, things that actually affect actors' everyday life, week-to-week life, that of course is going to look different than the WGA. But I think that most people in SAG and most actors are really grateful for WGA kind of kicking open that door, because the main thing that it says is that SAG goes into this knowing that the AMPTP is full of shit in terms of what their line is. Like, we will not cross this line. And now SAG can be like, okay, well, let's cut through that noise, because obviously that's not true. You guys just did this. So that puts us at a completely different starting point than where the WGA had to start from and start 100 days earlier from.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, Adam Conover is probably going to be your best source of information, Bruce. But, you know, there's all of those big ticket items that we're talking about are all items that they said they wouldn't concede to. From the very top, like very, very vocal about. And when you looked at the contracts or our proposals and their counter proposals, they're all things that they said that they had, that they offered no counter proposal to. And so that's way different. Like there's a number of items where they ordered, they offered a counter proposal and maybe it's a little under the number or something like that. Or maybe they went, we'll have a meeting about, or they gave us the proposal itself. Right. But these three big items, success-based residuals, protections against AIs, transparency, these are all things they 100% said they wouldn't do. And when they offered a counter proposal, it said no counter proposal. So we is exactly what Roxy said, is that they're full of shit, right? Like they're not operating in good faith and they actually can give us all of these things. And in all honesty, the frustrating thing about this is that before streaming, we had these things, right? We have ratings, right? We have success-based field-based residuals, right? We had based on foreign residuals, right? Like we got paid, you know, if this is airing in Spain or France or Portugal, right? We had all of these things. And once streaming became a thing, they just decided not to do these things, right? And sort of that's how these contracts go, is that the minute they cannot give us the things they've previously given us, they'll not give it to us, you know? And that's kind of the pattern of production companies or the major distributors, right? That happened when movies went to television. They were like, we don't know how to pay people on television, right? Like they went, we don't know, once television went to videotape, they were like, we don't know how videotape works. We don't know how to really tell you how anybody gets videotapes. Like
the money keeps coming in, but we don't really know how it's happening. So what are we supposed to do? I don't know.
I mean, people forget that we didn't win residuals through negotiating. We won residuals through strikes. Right? Like people keep forgetting that a lot of the things that we take for granted are things that we didn't negotiate for. We had to fight in a strike. Like the fact that staff writers get a script fee was not negotiated. That was struck for, you know, like minimum room size was negotiated. It was struck for. And so people forget how, one, how powerful strikes are, but two, how necessary they are. And three, how much they prove that the parent company and the management is full of shit.
Absolutely. And I think it's one thing I kind of hope for that maybe we can get even some more progress on with SAG is, if I'm understanding the language correctly with the WGA deal, you know, like you were saying, the merit-based residuals and this idea of being more transparent with the numbers on streamers. But it is kind of like, all right, we will take those numbers in a locked box and give them to the WGA, and then they will read them. And it's like, I'd like to just know. I think that should be public information. I think that would be great if we could get to that point.
And I'm not sure what merit they're using to do it publicly. Like, right, we're all used to Nielsen from before and a third party. And I haven't read or remembered it to the extent of knowing that it's a third party. I know a previous version of their counter proposal was exactly what you said.
Yeah.
It was, we will allow a writer and a WGA member to see the numbers and only them.
And then if they put up black smoke, it means that, and it's like, or just tell people, like, I find it really suspicious how closely you're trying to guard your numbers. Was, like, what aren't you telling us?
that was the counter proposal. And I also hope it fuels the folks. I hope it fuels all the detractors. And I don't mean this in a gloating screw you sort of way. You know, there were prominent entertainers, stand-ups and actors who were like, well, if we expose the numbers, you know, they're all playing a numbers game and, you know, we're striking ourselves out of a job because the money's not really there.
Yeah.
Right. And here's the thing. The money is there. These are billion-dollar companies. There's no billion-dollar anything that runs out of money in the history of the world.
Yeah.
Right. So what we're really doing is they're playing a mix and match game. They're playing a shell game. It's like, yes, this show might not be as popular, but the money is still there. And then this other show that is popular that you haven't told us about, the money is still there. Like Apple's not running out of money.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so, you know, for us to have a share is not that big a deal, particularly when you have the CEOs who get $30 million bonuses,
yep.
Regardless of performance.
Yeah, it's crazy how much their fear tactics have worked, because people in the industry, not even talking about out of the industry, but people in the industry, our peers, really do say things like, but do they don't have the money. And it's like, how they have convinced people that they don't have the money while taking home a $450 million check every 2 years.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Zasloff. I'm looking at you, Iger. Like, it's just insanity that they people really are so afraid and believe that if they ask for a living wage for their time, that the show will fold because they couldn't possibly have the money. And it's like, how can you think that when you know that the people at the very top are making tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year?
It's exactly what you said. It's the tactics. I have a comedian buddy, and he had pointed out to, and I'm specifically referencing this, how someone had said, we're going to be striking ourselves out of the business. And then I showed him the initial form, because that's the other hard thing. We're all kind of negotiating in a bubble, right? So the greater masses, in order to not create panic, there's a bit of secrecy in order so that everything's not, you know, being turned into a thread and being misunderstood.
Yeah.
So it's very important how we disseminate information. And so I showed him the proposal thing that said our total package would cost the companies 2%. Mm-hmm. All of the companies combined, the total value of the package would cost them 2%. And each of the companies, it would cost them less than 1%. It would cost them a percentage of 1%. And he saw it and was like, oh. Yeah. He was like, that seems doable. And he was like, yeah, but they're not talking about residuals. And I was like, oh, you don't understand that. Not us, not me, but the NEGCON committee, right? The people who are involved, and it's not just actors doing math. They've worked out the value of these packages, right? We have finance people on our side, accountants on our side, who are doing the numbers. So when we talk about residuals, they know how much that costs. They know how much a 5% raise over 110,000 members costs. You know what I mean? So it doesn't come out of nowhere. So when WGA said, we want this 5% raise this year, 4% raise this year, 3% raise this year, success-based residuals, it was an understanding of how much this total value would be.
Yeah.
And I think people don't get that. I think people are like, well, it'll cost them tons. We don't even know how much it'll cost. Like, no, we do. We do. We have mathematicians.
Yeah.
This is a set-based scale, the same way we did when there were ratings for television,
yep.
for network television. We do for streaming. It's not that complicated. And they realize it costs the companies less than 1%. Even this amount that we've asked for, or that the WJ has asked for, will not change their bottom line.
Yeah.
At all.
How have you been affected in the last 148 days? Has this had a huge effect on your life?
Yeah, I don't make any money. that's been the biggest effect, is that I can't work at all. You know, I feel fortunate in that I got work right before this happened.
Yeah.
So I wasn't in a state of fear like so many of my SAG members, WGA members are. And I'm always kind of, you know, I always say this, I grew up broke. And then when I moved to Hollywood, I got on TV and I went broke again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something I really fear in that regard. Cause I've gone there and come back at different stages of my life. And I live relatively humbly. So it's not that crazy.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Malcolm, but you're on TV. So that must mean that you have like five houses and several yachts.
All the houses.
Because I've seen your face on the screen, so that means.
I don't know if you know this. Yeah. This is our original Monet.
Yeah.
It's just because I know that.
This is actually a real humble brag. This is actually from Portia de Rossi.
Yeah.
I was on a TV show with her. I was on Better Off Dead, and she was heavy in the painting.
Yeah.
So this
Portia de Rossi made that for you.
Portia de Rossi made this one.
That's better amazing. Than Monet. Okay, right. Let's go.
Right.
You're better dropping the tea than me.
Yeah.
They go, I'm spilling that tea, baby.
So in the chat, Leonard Kim says, all people have to do is look up the financial statements of these companies. They're doing just fine. And I think, you know, obviously we are talking about these strikes are going on right now, but there's also the auto workers and everything. And I do think, I hope because of the amount of tension these strikes get, that, and it appears that we are seeing a broader labor movement in the country, which I think is important for a lot of reasons, not the least of which, context for the casual dystopia we live in is Malcolm was just talking about the what actors could ask for. And one of the things was, yeah, if we're filming in a state that doesn't allow abortion and we have to figure that out, it's like, that's fucking wild that we have to think about that shit. So hopefully this makes me hopeful, and not just for our industry, but as challenging as strikes are, specifically as Malcolm was just talking about on the individuals that are part of those industries, and we're talking about auto workers, how it might impact people outside of that or just people that live in this country. I do hope that it seems like people have a broader understanding of why it matters, which I really think is a stark reminder of the L corporations have created for themselves, that they have undone decades of convincing people that everything they do is right. And now people, they've pushed it so hard that like your average person's like, wait a second, am I being fucked over? And it's like, yes, you are.
I think Elon Musk actually helped, because people were like, wait, maybe you're not rich because you're smart.
Boom. Yeah. He ruined it for the rest of them. It's like, if you could have just shut up, people would still think.
Like, they're like, yeah, all rich people are smart. And like, you screwed it up. Peter Zaslav screwed it up too, because people are like, how do you not sell Batman?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. How are you not able to profit with Batman? If you need to sell off Batman, what do you think you can sell better?
Yep. What are you doing?
Than Batman.
While we're talking about all this, you know, and we talked earlier about Malcolm.
I'm excited to see the segue, by the way.
Thank you. Here we go. I'm making it up on the fly. Malcolm was, we talked a bit about Malcolm's ability to pivot and all the things he does. One of those things is performing live theater. And there's currently an Indiegogo. There's a link in the whatever. If you're listening to this, watching this, there's going to be a link in the description to go check it out. He's on a play called Brushstroke. Malcolm, can you tell us about that?
Yes. So Brushstroke is about the government's efforts to use the 1950s art scene to weed out socialists and propagate democracy.
Yeah.
And so there was secretly a program that I can't remember off the top of my head. That was specifically aimed at going at the beatniks and the art scene of the 50s and in New York to sort of gain national interest and again to create patriotism and also rooting out artists who may be communists, but at the same time using that sort of counterculture art to promote American ideals.
And so I play
a patriot and an art enthusiast who is doing his best to operate with that objective.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that a side wink that we just threw out there?
There's amount of intrigue and surprise in a play, and amount of comedy in a play.
Yeah.
And so it's a great. And so it's it's kind of like there's certain secrets I can't tell. There's a couple reveals that are pretty early. So I'm like,
well, there's literally a government agent right now off camera. Like you can't,
yes,
you can't.
The red laser, yeah.
So
how did you feel the first time you read it? Were you like, oh, this is definitely something I want to be a part of?
Yeah, I definitely did. I definitely read it like, oh, this is like super interesting. And also playing like playing a patriot was interesting for me, particularly one at this point in one as a black person. It's always like there's always a weird thing about patriotism to this government, right? But two, as a modern day citizen, watching our government, watching an insurrection mm-hmm. aided by members of our government, while, you know, the leading GOP candidate is, you know, under indictment for 91 felonies, and watching what it means to be a patriot and watching people claim patriotism while supporting someone who supported an insurrection.
Yeah.
It's always an interesting idea of like, what does it mean to be a patriot in America and who does it most benefit? And so that was interesting for me to do that in a 1950s world,
yeah.
and as a black man today, but also in a 1950s world. And what's interesting is that, you know, John didn't write it to be a brother.
Yeah.
He just wrote it. And then, you know, me and him, John Ross Bowie is the writer. If you don't know, he's also an actor. He's been in tons of stuff. And we know each other because we had been in a callback. And, you know, when you're in a callback with folks, or not a callback, a screen test. When you're in a screen test with folks, you kind of stick with each other because you're like, it was me or you, mm-hmm. you know, and it wound up being Alfonso Ribeiro.
Yeah.
I don't know what role that me, John Ross Bowie, and Alfonso Ribeiro are going for, but he wrote it. He wrote it just to be whoever, right? Probably white because he's white.
Yeah.
But he gave it to me, and it's interesting because there's a line. My character is very patriotic, and there's a line where he's talking about all the things that we as a government have fought for, and there's a line about segregated lunch tables and this and that, blah blah. And he was like, "Should I take that out?" And I was like, "God, no! Don't take that line out. Yeah. Please, don't take that line out." I was like, yeah, you see that feeling that you have because I'm saying it? That's a beautiful feeling.
Yeah.
Like whatever uncomfortability it has or whatever amount of thoughts that are rushing into your mind right now, that's what we want the audience to have. Like, I think too often we want the audience to be comfortable even when we're creating conflict,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think sometimes we're afraid of the conflict that arises in having characters of that are non-white because we don't know that experience.
Yeah.
And we're afraid of the powder keg that could happen as a result because I can't chess match people's reaction to this thing the way I would if it was someone who was the same skin color as me speaking as someone who isn't black.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was really amazing to do that. On top of that, I just really love dialogue, and the dialogue in it really moves. You know what I mean? I love Pinter. I love Mamet. I love the, you know, I love Tarantino for comparing it to movies.
Yeah.
And so I usually do probably one play a month. A year. And when I saw this play, I was like, this is the play to do this year. Because the character just goes through these sort of ups and downs, and I get to be someone who is altruistic in a way that I am not, optimistic in a way that I am not, mm-hmm. And gets to speak in ways that I enjoy. And I got to be with James Urbaniak, who's an amazing actor who I saw, I want to say 20 years ago in New York. And he did a one-man show, which was the only one-man show I'd ever see again.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got the opportunity to work with him, I jumped at the chance immediately.
That's awesome.
Does the role affect your patriotism in real life, either more or less, or no, because you have found a way to just completely compartmentalize?
In general, I'm compartmentalized all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm giving you 10% of my brain right now. The rest is at Facebook.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's affected me just yet because I haven't done it on stage just yet.
Yeah.
Reading it once or twice, I don't know. There's some symbolism and some things I relate to that I take with me that attracted me to it, but I don't think I'm going to be affected until I do it, and then I'll have a better answer regarding that.
Yeah, okay, come back.
Come back once the play's done. Yeah, so right now, just to remind everybody, is on Indiegogo. There's a link in the description. They're raising money for it because you got to pay the people that are doing the thing, everybody.
Theater's poor and no one makes money in theater, which is why I only do one play a year.
Yeah, well, and I was going to ask you about that. I relate to that because having, you know, run campaigns for comics, it's like nobody, it's not, please, this isn't how people make money and I need to pay my artists. So for you, what is the simplest version of the questions? What's the difference between doing theater and being on the TV? No, but like, you know, what for you, like, what's the appeal of doing live theater over maybe doing something on screen? You know, you say you do it once a year. That's clearly a choice. You're not doing it for the money. That's a choice. You're doing it for a reason.
It's kind of a lot. Yeah. It's often to do it comparatively.
Yeah, it's... I do it because there's literally no other feeling like it. To go there, there's a fear factor and an excitement factor, because you really don't know what's going to happen on any given night that you do a play. You know, like you can do a scene a million times and they're going to record it and you're going to mess up maybe, and then they'll stop and then they'll record it again and then you'll wait around.
Yeah.
So this is really different in that you're going to be there and you have to be fully engaged for 2 hours. Like, that's the thing about doing theater, is that you're playing a character for 2 hours at a time. When you're doing TV or movies, you're playing a character 5 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you do that scene and then they cut, or someone messes up and then we cut. And then we wait, and then they change lights for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And we come back. It's why you can get, you know, no disrespect, it's why you can get a film actor who's not as good as a theater actor, because we can edit.
Yep.
Right. Like, whereas, you know, you're on stage, you have to do whatever that other person did. There was one time I did a play, and it takes place in an office, but they take mushrooms and then things get weird.
Love it.
So my character's taking mushrooms, right? The next scene, things are going to get weird. We cut to the next, we don't cut, it's theater.
Yeah.
We transition
into
the next scene in darkness. And then what has to happen in theater is that some items need to be removed on stage and some items need to be placed on stage.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe it happens in darkness in a span of a couple seconds. Maybe there's music and lights to do this and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling the effects. Scene change happens. I'm supposed to be sitting at a desk, or I go to my desk to sit there and start work. My desk is there, but the chair is not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way around it.
Yeah.
And I don't even really have dialogue. The other two characters do. So because I'm on shrooms, I just sit down.
Mm-hmm.
And I sit down at my desk and start working.
Yeah.
And moving things. And it oddly enough worked, because my character was gone and we've entered a new world, and you know, it's a thing of like, how do you acknowledge without acknowledging, you know? How do you acknowledge without overdoing it? And that's not a thing that's ever going to happen in a TV or film, right? Like, that is a once in a lifetime experience that audience got to share, and that me and the cast got to share, that I got to yell at the stage manager about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of these things. But it's a once in a lifetime experience. You can't do that. Like, I remember one time, that same play, at the end of it, you know, we break the fourth wall.
Yeah.
I like to break the third wall as well.
Yeah.
I like to break all the walls.
You know, yeah, exactly. Second wall. Let's throw the second wall in there. Like, if we can break these walls, let's
put up more walls. I want to break them.
Yeah.
It's better than building. Let's build a wall.
Exactly.
Whatever you say, let's break the
walls.
Don't
build a wall in theaters. You know what I mean? But I remember the end of the play, we sort of go like, come with us, let's go, you know, like as we leave the theater and run to our whatever, you know, our emotional freedom.
Yeah.
And I would hold the hand of the person sitting in the middle at the very end, like, let's go. And it was this big moment, you know what I mean, where the audience got to really be with me. And so I remember I did it one time, and as I went, the person stood up with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we left the theater together and ran out. And I was like, holy shit, I didn't know this was going to happen.
Yeah.
So then I got used to that. I got used to grabbing a hand and having someone wanting to go with me. So one of our last shows, there's a woman in the front of the audience. I grab her hand. I'm like, let's go. And she's like, not really moving. I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, let's get up. She's got like a broke leg, or like she's some sort of, something doesn't work with her leg.
Yeah.
I notice, I look down, and it's like one leg or something. I don't even know. I'm like, in my head, right? Not on my, in my head, I'm like, oh, you fucking asshole. Oh, this is fucking horrible. And then it's a split second. I'm having all these thoughts, right?
Yeah.
And then she goes, and she leans down, gets her cane, stands up with me. And beautiful. I take her arm, and we slowly walk out together.
Love it.
You know? And it was, this magical one. Like, I got goosebumps right now thinking about it. And it's just like, that is an experience she can only have there.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I can only have there. And I can't repeat. Yep. You know, I can't make that happen ever again. Even when I was trying to repeat something, I couldn't make it happen in the same way. And so that, for me, is the beauty of theater, being able to touch people so closely, so immediately, in that room and in that experience. And hopefully that'll be the same experience with this play, just in a different way.
If theater made you as much money, would you only do theater? Like, the way you sound so passionate about it makes me think that that's the jam, but it's just not a viable livelihood.
I guess I do. I keep saying that I don't want to do it, and I keep.
Yeah.
I was like an artistic director for 10 years, two different theater companies. So it was my life for a very long period of time, and again, nonprofit. Yeah. So I might, you know, the hard part about theater is that it's so engulfing. Yeah. You know, you rehearse a play for, you know, roughly a month and a half, 2 months, you know? So it's a lot of your life. And so that's why it's hard to do that and do a million other things. You know what I mean? If you're not getting paid highly, it's 2 months of rehearsal. And depending on how long a run you have, you know, 1 to 2 months of that. So it's like 4 months of your life. But my first big gig was a theater gig. I did Wit, and I was on tour with Judith Light in the lead role. And so
that
I was like,
is
18
so months. Cool.
Oh yeah, I got to see him naked from behind for like 6 months. it was a really wild ride. She gave me one of my first journals to write in, you know. And so that was a great experience, but also kind of rough because I was the youngest person in the group. You know, I think at the time I was 18, and the second youngest person involved in a production was like 30. Yeah. So it was a wild ride, but it was a great experience because I got to tour, I got to see America. You know, I don't think Americans get to see America as much. You know, we all could stand to travel a lot, definitely outside of the country.
Yeah.
But I had never, you know, as an 18-year-old Brooklyn kid, I had never really seen much of any other city or state. And I got to see six of them in the span of, 6 months. So, you know, again, that's a whole other experience.
Yeah. So, and when you were talking about it, Rex, you mentioned, you know, how passionate you were. It got me a little emotional hearing it. So if people want to have those experiences, support local theater. All right. TV's great. Movies are great. It's great that you can access those anywhere. But if you have a local theater scene, which I guarantee you almost everybody out there does, check it out. If you want to support Malcolm, you want to support live theater, again, go to the link in the description for Brushstroke, or go to Indiegogo, type in Brushstroke. It'll pop up. I backed it. You should back it. Check it out. Malcolm, as we wrap up here, as far as the stuff, I'm going to tell everybody home, check out Malcolm's IMDb. There's a bunch of stuff in there you can check out. There may or may not be a show on Apple TV Plus right now that he's very good in that you should check out. But for the things you're allowed to mention, what should people be on the lookout for from you?
You know, just go to my Instagram. There'll be some information, I'm sure, or IMDb. I mean, honestly, the Indiegogo for Brushstroke is a really big deal. That would be great. There may be a show that I'm on that's doing pretty good.
Yeah.
And then there may be a show about a regular dude if you wanted to put your eyeballs on a network at some point, that might be the thing. One striking is over. Just follow my Instagram. I keep people pretty involved there. Verbal Be Rapping or at Malcolm Barrett on my Twitter as well. Maybe I'm on Blueski. I don't know.
It's a real crapshoot at this point. I don't know where we're landing. I wish people would just tell me.
Instagram is where I definitely am. So definitely go there. Verbal Be Rapping. I'll tell you all about my stand-up comedy and what shows you can watch.
Yeah.
Once the strike is over,
follow them, check that out. Roxy, what should the kids be looking out for from you?
You can find me everywhere at Roxy Stryer. That's where I post all the things, or at least all the things that I'm allowed to post during this time.
You can find me at DJ Talks Trash. You can find this show everywhere that matters at Only Stupid Answers, but on Twitter/X.
Yank out the vowels from stupid.
I want to thank everybody that joined us live, and we will see you all next time. Bye, everybody.